You were saying that in Vietnam there were these opportunities to experience things that you might not ever experience or not even think of it because of these things. And you mentioned something about Hugh?
Well, yeah. When Hugh and I were in Saigon, and we would, you could rent, or not rent, you'd have an IVS vehicle and be allowed to take it and just drive around. You signed it out of the IVS headquarters, and we would go, as I said, down to different bars, particularly in the area called Kinh Hoi, which was by the docks. There were a lot of, Hugh and I both liked similar music, which was a lot of sort of the Miracles, the Temptations, those sort of black groups that were singing at the time, and there were a lot of the bars down there played this music, so we'd go down and listen to that. But after being there, sometimes we would see flares in the distance, and the IVS had Government of Vietnam license plates on all their vehicles. They were VN license plates. And you could drive around all night. There was no curfew for IVSers. You didn't have to be in bed at a certain time, even though there were curfew for the military. So we could go, and we would go out sometimes and just follow the flares to go out to see what was going on in different places. And sometimes with the bar girls, not sleeping with them, but we'd stay and close the bar, and then they'd take us back to their houses, and we'd eat with them, cook dinner. You know, they'd eat very late dinners and meet their families and talk and just, again, have a sociable evening, not a... a wild evening, but just you know, getting to know people at a different, with a different background and a different level. Don Luce never knew, but I took his car one of the first times we were in Saigon. It was a black Chevy, and we went down to Kinh Hoi. And I remember couldn't find a place to park, and I finally saw a place, and I parked and got out of the car. And Hugh said, "Don, you're on railroad tracks." And I said, "Hugh, they blow up bridges around here. There are no railroads that are running in Vietnam." And we went to the bar and came out, I don't know, a couple hours later, and the car was gone. And I thought, this is really bad, because Don is the chief of party for IVS. And, of course, in the docks, they did have trains going around that they could offload things between boats. And I went up and down the street, you know, anybody seen this car? And there was this one woman that had a stall said, "You go around the corner," and we went around the corner, and there was... Don's car was in front of a police station surrounded by concertina wire. It had government plates on it. And apparently the police had either picked it up or in some way moved it off the track and then were protecting it, were guarding it, because it had these plates. And so we went in and talked with them, and they just thought, you know, this was a great deal, and got some beer, and we drank, you know, I mean, drank some more with them and talked and headed back to the IVS house, you know. And, I remember thinking, you know, this would definitely not go down well if we lost Luce's car in the middle of Saigon. But I think that for me, that part of the interest in this whole experience was to improve. When I think about my students in Vietnam.
Thinking of your,
thinking of the kids. I mean, I can really see these kids, and Si Da is one of my students, and Hua, the different kids, and it was the younger kids that I really worked with, whose English I saw really improve during the 2 years, so that they had a level of beginning fluency after 2 years of studying that was quite good. And I really took a lot of pride in that. That felt very good. I remember also trying to organize them to do some social works in the town, and that being sort of a bust. And the principal of my high school, Mr. Hong, Bui Bang Hong, and I heard he was assassinated, required me to go up before the whole student assembly of the whole high school in their morning assembly. And say in Vietnamese that I wanted to have people volunteer, and why I thought it was a good thing for people to volunteer to do. You know, I was trying to spread the word. I mean, it was really, again, this sort of mix of chauvinism and naivete. And we built some toilets in the local area, but the kids lost interest in it over time, and actually Jacques Loriot and a bunch of Air Force guys helped me finally put the lid mm-hmm. on the septic part of the toilet in the back. Mm-hmm. It was a long process. The students in the night school also were very interesting. I had students ranging in age from 8 to 78. When the guy was 78, I remember him saying one night to me, he said, well, it's very important for me to learn English because I need to work, and it's the language that's going to get me employment. Mm-hmm. And it put a different light on what I thought, you know, English language acquisition would be. Because again, I saw that there's a way, not so much of immediate employment, which is, in fact it was, as the military came in and increased in numbers, anybody that had English language skills was getting hired mm-hmm. and really made a difference in a very immediate sense to their economic status. And I saw it in a longer term venue of, you know, access to information and sort of long term improvement or at least, you know, being able to make decisions, incorporating ideas that were maybe technologically more salient to them than what they were currently basing their, you know, either rice production or mm-hmm. office management practice or whatever, that they would just have this other opportunity for information. Mm-hmm. That turned out to be more of a short-term gain for a lot of these folks. I liked seeing the kids learn language as well as they did. And it was also frustrating for me at my age. Again, I keep thinking, you know, at that age, I wasn't very mature. And I got frustrated with some of them. And one way that this came out was in the taekwondo. Mm-hmm. A lot of my students were doing taekwondo, and after class at night, we'd go down into the market and drink milkshakes, which were made of fresh fruit, whatever. I happen to like pineapple. And then they would put in coconut milk and condensed sweet milk and ice and just whir it up in a blender, mm-hmm. and it was delicious. And talk, you know, just hang out and talk about whatever. I mean, it wasn't heavy-duty stuff. It was just, you know, going hanging out with the students. Mm-hmm. But over time, as my abilities increased in taekwondo, you spar with people. And I actually got to the point, and not at all proud of this, where I would be angry with the students and physically use the taekwondo to vent some of my anger. And it frightened me enough so that I actually went to the instructor, the Vietnamese instructor, and a group of my students saw me going there and sort of tagged along, and I withdrew from the class. I told them I couldn't continue doing it because I wasn't doing it in I didn't have the right frame of mind in which to do it. And he understood that, I think, and kind of respected the decision that I came to. Mm-hmm. Part of what I think was going on was a frustration and immaturity, and I think part of that, if I had had a team leader, mm-hmm. you know, or someone sort of who could mentor me in a way, but Pete had been killed and they really hadn't sort of stepped up to. You know, Carly was available, but I think because I was living with Ian at that point, it was awkward for them to mm-hmm. To deal with me like another IVSer, mm-hmm. and in the sense of having her come down to.
But you'd also made a point of kind of cutting your own path.
Yeah.
And that made it harder, too. I mean, they didn't want to make things more complicated. They felt if you knew what you were doing, then, well, go ahead and do it,
yeah.
without realizing that you're still, what, 20, 22 years old. You know, it's...
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't much older than some of the students in some ways. Mm-hmm. So it's been, you know, since coming, well, I mean, this is sort of leaping back to the present, but One of the things that happened after I started working with refugees, and I wrote some journal articles about it and things of that sort that were published, and so I went back to Washington to testify in congressional hearings about the mental health status of refugees. And I remember walking into a briefing, or not a briefing, but where I was going to give a presentation, and there was a Vietnamese guy who was walking in carrying a stack of briefing books. And I looked at him and I immediately knew him as one of the teachers from Vung Tau High School.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him in Vietnamese, I said, you used to be a lot fatter when I knew you. And he looked at me and he saw, and I had this mustache, and you know, mm-hmm. And then he recognized me. He dropped this whole stack of briefing books, and I've stayed in touch with him. And he was at that time the head of refugee affairs for South Carolina, and he hired me as a consultant to come down there and help him sort of iron out this turf war that was going on between him and some other agency people.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down there as a consultant, and his name is Tri, T-R-I,
mm-hmm.
and he's now the head of refugee services for the state of Arizona. And he called me just about 3 or 4 months ago. He's a pretty much of a cut your own path kind of a guy. He said, Christ, he said, he called me on the phone, he said, I can't find out where the hell your beach is. He said, I've been driving around for hours. I said, you know, you ought to call me a little bit before you come out here and make plans, you know. He was just out here, so he showed up, you know. And he stayed at a hotel over in town. We got together and had dinner and had a nice visit. But he'll call up from time to time. And I saw a couple of former students of mine. I did an evaluation for a young refugee woman whose child was severely delayed. And I ran a program at San Francisco General Hospital. I was kind of like the court of last resort. A lot of refugees somatize their psychological problems. They just don't have the same ways of expressing themselves about bad things. And this woman was referred to me, and during the course of the interview, I realized that I'd taught English to her in Vietnam, and she'd been she didn't know who I was.
Mm-hmm.
But when she realized it, she just started crying. I mean, you know, you hear this stuff about, oh, Vietnamese aren't emotional, mm-hmm. but it just isn't, you know. She was so overwhelmed, and, you know, I was touched too, just to see her and to see the situation that she was in with this youngster. And,
to a severely delayed?
Yeah, developmentally delayed.
Oh, developmentally.
Yeah. She had neurological. Mm-hmm. Problems that
you know. Oh, and I understood that when you said refugee counseling, I was thinking delayed in another country and couldn't get back.
No.
That's why I mentioned that. Yeah. Now I understand.
So this was like mental health.
Right.
You know, I'm a psychologist. I have a clinical license in
mm-hmm.
California, so I can do educational evaluations,
mm-hmm.
which I do periodically still for Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was doing at the general, at the hospital. For 4 years, the county of San Francisco gave me a small grant for a part-time position for myself there,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of the refugees would show up regularly in medical clinics repeatedly, and
mm-hmm.
they could never find anything wrong. And so they would then get sent to see me,
mm-hmm.
and I would talk with them and try and help them to understand that some of what they may be experiencing physically might have other causes,
mm-hmm.
and that there were other ways of trying to think about it, et cetera. Not imposing so much our psychodynamic understanding
mm-hmm.
of things, but at least to broaden a bit their understanding of what they might be experiencing physiologically, and to have them think about it in other terms, and to talk with me just about their experience. I mean, I would always just talk about, just like you and I are having a conversation now, about where I learned Vietnamese, where were they from in Vietnam, what was their experience like coming out of the camps. I do a very sort of historical, and in some instances it really seemed to gave them an opportunity to sort of go back through their own evolution of life in Vietnam, transition to refugee camp or flight from Vietnam, readjustment here, and just the process of talking about it seemed to be a relief to some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some it didn't help at all, but it was another part of my work. But I've had opportunities to run into people over here that I knew there, and
mm-hmm.
that's been really pretty heartwarming and nice to make those connections again.
Yes, it seems that the most productive thing, and I don't mean productive in a positive way, but the most physical of all the legacies of America's involvement in Vietnam is the transference of large numbers of the population of Southeast Asia to North America, whether it's Hmong, Cambodian, Laotian, or Vietnamese. And a large number of those people, naturally, were people who had some contact with Americans overseas. And from a world history perspective, we're not talking about America's immigration problems, I'm not interested in that, but world history perspective, it's quite interesting. Rather an interesting brain transfer. Who these people were, where they were in their culture, and where they are now. Everyone talks about how, I mean, President Key has a liquor store kind of thing.
And I don't know what Key's up
to. Well, he had a lot more than just a liquor store, but the point is that, in other words, a lot of things did transfer directly. But other people were cabinet ministers, for example, run restaurants. And to an American, that seems to be an enormous come down. They don't, in other words, Americans don't have a frame of reference for looking at the Southeast Asian immigrant experience. They don't have any way. Except now, of course, we know very few Americans know anything about Vietnam. I mean, the younger generation is disconnected. I mean, they're curious, which is nice. Whatever happened with your romantic attachment, as long as we're talking about
it? Oh, Ian? You know, we at the very end, it was very hard to leave her and to leave Vietnam and to leave her. Mm-hmm. I gave her a big sewing machine. Yeah, you can close it. To sort of set her up in what I thought would be some sort of productive business. And funny story. I took her to get X-ray to get a big health exam at the end, and they found cancer in a breast. And I remember walking around trying to figure out how I was going to explain this to her, which I finally did. And at that point, she confided in me that she'd had implants. It wasn't cancer. Yeah, it wasn't cancer at all. I can't tell you how relieved I was. I've got boxes of letters from her in there that she kept in diaries and things that she sent me. She wrote me almost daily after I left, and we corresponded regularly. And she, the father of her child, went back to Vietnam and married her, brought her back to the United States. When I was in the Army, I went down to Texas. I saw her down there. She looks wonderful, is doing well, and she lives in New Hampshire now, and is married and with Bob Noyes is the fellow's name, and Jimmy is grown, and you know, is now
35 years old.
Yeah.
So all that could.
So anyway, she's in the United States now, and married, and with the father of Jimmy. But we had you know, a very long and lengthy correspondence after I came out. It was like 7 years after that, or 6 years after that, she came. It wouldn't have been that long. 4 years after that, I guess you could think.
Well, how did you feel? How did you feel at the end of your IVS tour?
I was tired. I think of what I was doing. I really questioned some of what the English teaching program was about.
What were you questioning? I mean, you were very proud that you were being effective in teaching them the language.
Yeah. I think I this issue of short-term gain and employment as part of the American build-up there, that the English language was being, it was more of an employment tool. It really wasn't how I had seen myself as going to Vietnam to help people. I had this, you know, originally, again, a sort of naive vision of this long-term information acquisition process. And it looked like it was turning into a kind of short-term job skill issue. People wanted to work for the Americans as interpreters or whatever, just mm-hmm. To get employment. And there was a tension that developed that I felt between the Vietnamese and the Americans, the military particularly. And I think IVS had a hard time getting away from that. Remember I said, you know, initially I went with the idea that you'd have a small footprint,
right.
And then it became, just because of the numbers of people, a big uh-huh. footprint. So I left in May, the very end of May, and went to Bangkok and saw my friend, the Charakabanajis,
mm-hmm.
and then flew to Israel on this Air France flight, which was the last plane to Tel Aviv the day the Six-Day War broke out. I was there and filled sandbags and had volunteered to work on a kibbutz, not, again, to do anything with weapons, but mm-hmm. that experience really gave me a sense of the need at times for people to defend themselves with weapons mm-hmm. and to kill. And so I wasn't couldn't be a conscientious mm-hmm. objector. And so when I came back to the United States, after going through Europe, and I met a woman traveling through Europe, a South African woman, and we're still friends. She lives in Johannesburg,
mm-hmm.
Has three daughters, and God, we talk with one another on the phone once or twice a year. When I got back to the United States, though, the country was so polarized around the war, and the war was such an issue that it just hadn't been when I left to go to Vietnam. I mean, it just was not, particularly maybe because it was Hanover, New Hampshire, where it wasn't like Berkeley, or it wasn't like Columbia, or, you know, an urban, and Vietnam was off the map. And then suddenly it was like this big issue. And I just, I couldn't take a side in it. I mean, I couldn't say it's bad to be there, or it's good to be there. I mean, because I kept thinking of all the pros and the cons and the people that I'd known and how it affected their lives. And I didn't have any idea of what I wanted to do still at that point. I was just really confused and still young. I mean, I came back, I was 23, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I got drafted in the fall of 67. I got a draft notice
mm-hmm.
and decided, well, if our system is going to work, and what I saw in Vietnam was a lot of youngsters who were cannon fodder, particularly out of my back door in the last year that I was there. I said, just because I went to a college and have an education, and yes, I could say, well, I'm a conscientious objector, I've done 2 years of alternate service, I'm going to protest this, I'm not going to go to Vietnam, I'm not going to go in the military, etc. I said, you know, our system just, and this again was, my father said, you're being naive. I remember him saying that. I said, you know, if people like me don't go in, having, you know, the knowledge that I do about things, the whole system is really, you know, is a joke. And the whole system is a joke.
As it turned out.
Yeah, but I went in. I went in, and, you know, I met some guys when I went through basic training at Fort Dix. Again, it was just an incredibly broadening experience in a way. I got to know some people. They got to know me. Very different people. I was certainly different from them. They had a real grudging respect for me over time. I mean, that's a whole other series of stories that I could go into, but I was clearly taken into a whole, be with a whole group of guys who were black, who, at the time, there were a bunch of riots going on in New Jersey, and they were going to call up our unit, and I was invited into this meeting of guys who were saying, if they call our unit, we're not going. And how are we going to do this? And I think because of my age, I was 24, and however they viewed me, I'd had to, at one point, get into a real physical fight with he was a Massachusetts Highway Patrol guy, who was a terrible bully. I just, at one point, said, I can't take this anymore. And, of course, he didn't know that I knew Taekwondo. went into a room with him and came out of the room, leaving him in the room. And my quasi sort of intellectual status, because I was reading a lot of books and stuff like that, sort of went out the window, and the people who were there sort of viewed me in a very different light at that point, and then this issue came up. Anyway, the experience was quite enriching in a way, and then I had 2 years of language school in Monterey, studying Mandarin Chinese, and they sent me to night school at the Monterey Institute of International Studies so that I could, the same professors that I had moonlighted at night teaching what they really loved, which was history, philosophy, poetry, China, all in Chinese, and Vietnamese and Mandarin are tonally very similar. Okay. So I was like, you know, again, down the road a bit in terms of my language acquisition. And I use Mandarin also to do evaluations and speak Mandarin currently, you know, fairly, certainly not fluently anymore, but it's what I, one of the languages that I did my my doctorate in was Mandarin for the new language requirement. Had to teach the University of Southern California how to give an exam in Mandarin, and had to make up the exam essentially for that because they didn't have anybody to test, test me. It was a really interesting twist.
Did you, when you were drafted, how did you end up getting assigned to Monterey?
I enlisted.
Oh, you enlisted? Okay.
Yeah, for the Army Security Agency, which is the only way I could get language school. But it gave me a choice then. If I had just accepted the draft and gone in for only 2 years, the likelihood of my going back to Vietnam is pretty high. If I went in for longer, I had some choice over what I would do or where I might be sent.
So you thought you did anyway, and it turned out to be correct.
It in fact, was the case. Yes. Well, I was assigned, I wanted to study Mandarin. They assigned me Japanese, but I got there and I found a kid who was assigned to study Mandarin who wanted to study Japanese. And we went and saw the sergeant in this unit, and he said, well, you both got in at the same time. Your course is going to start at the same time, so I don't care. Yeah, switch. So, you know. It's even within that structure, there's certain chain of command things that you have to follow. I mean, I used to fill out regularly these forms, these suggestion forms, and send them in. And if I didn't get responses, you know, I'd make sure that I got responses. You know, I argued bitterly against the all-volunteer army. I think that was a terrible mistake for the very reason that I ended up being in the army. I think that we ought to have some sort of mandatory service. Whether it's military or otherwise, I just feel very strongly that people who come from different backgrounds should, you know, I mean, it's sort of like the VISTA idea, or the VISTA, Volunteers in Service to Vietnam idea. I mean, you do need to bring people from different backgrounds in contact with one another. The Army did that in a wonderful way. It doesn't happen anymore. And I think, I don't see this as a direct outgrowth, but I think one thing that contributes to this polarization that's occurred in our society, or this stratification that's occurred between the haves and the have-nots, and this increasing gap that's developing between intellectuals and non-intellectuals, is because we don't rub elbows with people who...
Well, fear and prejudice are almost always expressions of ignorance anyway, so, and fear, so, and approximation wears down
exactly.
The lack of knowledge, so it does help. The when you so you were in the Army for 3 years, though?
Three and a half. Yeah. Two years of which were in language school, and a year in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Year and a half.
And you came out in enlisted man?
Yeah, sergeant. I wouldn't. I mean, they kept saying, "Why don't you go in? You know, you got a college degree. You're, you know."
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, "I'm fine."
And. While you were in the Army Security Agency, you started taking correspondence with USC.
Yeah.
In education. In education.
Yeah, in Taiwan.
And when you got out,
I went into graduate school in education, and then started studying counseling education and clinical psychology, and got a PhD. I got out of the Army in 1971, and finished my PhD in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Came here. That was the year Saigon fell.
Mm-hmm. What'd you think about that?
About Saigon falling,
mm-hmm.
or
no? About Saigon falling. Yeah. Did you have any reaction to that at all?
Other than on a personal level, I was glad. I was relieved the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And on a personal level, just the people that I knew wondering about their fate.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them I know have been killed. Some I've seen. some I have no idea about. That's part of the reason I'd like to go back to Phuong Tha. I'd like to go back to, you know, to Vietnam. Chris, I know, has been back quite a bit. Chris Jenkins, and you know, we'll have a wonderful opportunity to talk with him. He and Tweet go back quite regularly, and he's working on a project there now, I know, that deals with smoking cessation, which was a grant that that he got and did quite a bit of work on that here with the refugee population.
And so because you, when you became licensed in as a clinical psychologist, you became, how did you first started working with refugees?
Oh, when I was in doing my postdoc, they came. And I would go down, just again as a volunteer, to Galileo High School and talk with kids in a, as a group. I just went down and said that I spoke Vietnamese. It came back fairly quickly. I would go down and talk about things with the kids, and we'd talk about things like the price of hamburgers, was, you know, bus fares were more. And then Presbyterian Hospital, where I did my postdoc, hired me back to set up a children and family service. But I really saw more of a need in the refugee community than I did. It's a silk stocking hospital, PMT. Got in touch with me because they'd heard that I spoke Vietnamese and asked me if I could do some work with them on developing a grant. And so we set up a mental health project at the International Institute, and I left PMC and I became the director of that project. It got funded. That was in 76, I think, or 70, yeah, 76. And I did that for 9 years. I didn't direct it, but I had stayed. What I did was I was the project director in year one, maybe year two. But then there's a Vietnamese doctor who was involved as a paraprofessional, who was just his language wasn't good enough to take his boards, his medical board, and I felt very strongly that a refugee should direct the project. So I became the training director, and then I became his consultant.
Right,
but. You know, the staff, ultimately, they all related to me as the director because the Cambodians wouldn't talk to the Vietnamese and the Laotians didn't like to, you know, and so it didn't really work as I'd envisioned it, as a, you know, but it was better to have him be the director anyway. And he's still a good friend. He's retired now. He's 80. I'd have lunch with him a couple times a month or, you know, maybe once a month on average. His daughter saw me in therapy for a while. She went through, she was graduated as the valedictorian at Galileo High School and went to Berkeley, graduated from Berkeley in psychology, and got a PhD in psychology and was in Dallas as a psychologist. I mean, there's so many different, you know, when I think about this, all the different connections and different relationships with people that have built up over the years. Like Ziu, this fellow, Dr. Ziu, and his daughter, and her going into psychology, and Ziu just hates it that she went into psychology, although he's sort of proud of it.
Is that D-I-U?
No, R-I, Ziu is Northern,
R-I-E-U. R-I-E-U.
Yeah.
When you finished with the setting up that program at the hospital, that brings us up to about...
Now, this is the mental health project?
The mental health project.
That really was at the International Institute of San Francisco.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then... That went to about 83, and then from 83 to 86 or 87, I had this project at the hospital. And then in 78, as part of my refugee work, the County of San Francisco Department of Social Services asked me to teach a seminar to their people about refugees. So I taught an 8-week seminar to their middle management and senior management about Southeast Asian refugees, once a week, 3 hours, a meeting, to old line social workers, and here I was like 30, whatever, you know, about refugees, and they were about as interested as, But I kept the, over the years, I mean, I still have these evaluations that they require them to do. And a couple of these guys who I've gotten to know over the years have said it was the best course they ever had. Mm-hmm. It was just, I mean, it was wonderful. It was mm-hmm. a wonderful experience. And the county kept hiring me to work then to develop mental health teams to go out with their child protective services to do evaluations of people in their homes for suspected child abuse and neglect. And so I had that part-time consulting all the time that I was doing related work. That's why after I was the project director, I stopped being full-time project director because I was interested in doing other things. So mm-hmm. I stayed as a consultant to Dr. Zia, mm-hmm. But did this work for the county and with Child Protective Services. And then other agencies around would hire me to do particular tasks that they had. I don't know what I would, some examples of that would be, we have this problem here, or how do we address such and such a social issue? Mm-hmm. And the county, so in 1987, the county of San Francisco said, we're seeing more drug-exposed babies that are coming into the system. Can you help design a program to meet that need? Mm-hmm. And so I helped set up a program for that. And then not only were the kids drug-exposed, but it turned out a number of them were HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And then in 1990, I got a grant from the federal government to research that, which I've got one more year of now. Mm-hmm. And then, again, that was like initially a full-time thing, and then I really never did it full-time. I guess I always did it like 90%, because I kept some options open for mm-hmm. myself, and I just did consulting. Mm-hmm. Edgewood Children's Center hired me. Hang on a second. Yeah. Different nonprofit agencies have hired me to help them with programs. Edgewood Children's Center called me 4 years ago to help them set up and organize a database because they never followed their kids. This is like one of the oldest agencies in San Francisco. It used to be called the San Francisco Protestant Orphanage. It was founded in 1858. And they take care of severely disturbed kids. So I help them with their database. Now it's the call before this was mm-hmm. about the database. Mm-hmm. This call is about another program that I've helped get going, which is grandparents taking care of their grandchildren, mm-hmm. Which predominantly black grandparents who are, because of drug use, mm-hmm. incarceration, whatever, the parents aren't available mm-hmm. To do this. And I've got a private foundation grant to do some research, outcome research on that. And this is a woman, Meredith Minko, that just called, who's written a book about grandparent caregivers and taking care of their crack cocaine exposed mm-hmm. children. Mm-hmm. And I'm using part of a qualitative interview that she did her book on mm-hmm. as part of my research. And so I'll be meeting with her to
great.
Sort of do some work with having her look over the various interviews that I've design various iterations of the same interview to work with the different populations. So the kind of work that I've done has continued to be service-related work. It's continued mm-hmm. to be at the community level. Mm-hmm. It's continued to, from my point of view anyway, this is how I see it. I don't know what, you know, it's just, it's kind of more action-oriented. I'm not very much of an intellectual in the sense of being at the university. I mean, I saw Berkeley I would go and teach one day a week. Mm-hmm. I saw the faculty there. I heard from the faculty what their issues were, how they viewed, you know, their various roles and responsibilities. I did it for 8 years, maybe 9 years, and then I resigned. I just, not because I was unhappy with it, I loved it.
You were something like an adjunct faculty?
Yeah, that's exactly right. What mm-hmm. I was. But I got too involved with these other programs in the city. I used to see Hugh, my friend who lived mm-hmm. in Berkeley, and you know, he had this very unusual accident and died, and that kind of made me sad. I'd go over there, and we would always run up in Strawberry Canyon in Berkeley. I don't mm-hmm. know if you know it.
Oh,
I'll
yeah.
be back,
yeah.
And then go down and drink beer and have dinner once a week, and you know, it was great.
You eventually married?
Yeah, mm-hmm. married in 1981, have two children, but I'm now divorced, and My oldest girl is going to be 15 in September. She's autistic. She's severely delayed, and I've spent quite a bit of time sort of in a whole other career. I've served as the president of a board of an organization in this county called Matrix, which is for parents of children who are disabled.
And the other child?
Nick is 13, sort of your garden variety 13-year-old, head of the rock and roll. We've been playing guitar now for a couple of years and wants to be the leader of a rock and roll band. They come back on Sunday from New Mexico. They've been down there with their mom for a part of the summer. But they just, she lives, my ex-wife lives just over the hill in Mill Valley. And we had a ranch together in New Mexico. Now she has the ranch in New Mexico. That's all fine.
Yes.
The kids were with me for the first 3 weeks of the summer, and then they've been with her for 3 weeks. Now they're back for a week, then they'll go down there for a couple of weeks, and then they'll be back with me for 3 weeks. I mean, it's a,
A 60s guy living in the 90s.
Is that what it is?
I think that's something, has something to do with it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. This brings, I think, an appropriate end, but we'll continue and we'll be looking at this documentation.